Welcome to another That's a Dive. I'm Kyle Martino. What's up, Tad Potters? Full disclosure, was just telling PJ, who's sitting next to me, back issues. Threw my back out. So if I'm not my normal cheery, over-animated self, I'm struggling with a little bit of a lower back injury.
I think the stress of sitting next to Robbie Musto from this past weekend mm-hmm. is finally
getting to up. You. It builds up. I mean, it's a powder keg. But yeah, gave my kids a bath on Saturday night, something I try to get out of because of all my playing injuries leading to me being basically Monty Burns when I walk around the house, just hunched over. And I said, you know what, let me give it a shot. I think I'm good. I think my lower back's good. And then, of course, the next day it goes out. But what are we going to do? You know, I know what we're going to do. We're going to go through a Tad Pod right now. That's going to make everyone feel better. But speaking of feeling better, you guys made me feel better with these reviews. Thank you so much, Tad Podders, for continuing to send these along. With your amazing soccer moments. It's just so cool to hear how you got hooked or hear that moment that really solidified the beautiful game in your heart. But let me check out these three. Let me pick my favorite. Okay, so here are three of my favorite from this past week. The first one's from AJ Piattoni. He said, as a Fire fan, I grew up to hate Kyle Martino. Sorry, nothing personal. Nothing personal, AJ. I get it. purely because of his crew affiliation. But I always respected his play, and now I respect his opinions and his point of view. He brings a different level of perspective to the sport, and his pod lays out three topics. The layout is genius. This isn't just another podcast that dives into game recaps and cookie-cutter analysis. No, Kyle takes three topics, sometimes uncomfortable topics, and also powers through the whistle. He didn't put that in there, but I will. And gives them attention and discussion they need. I didn't hesitate to subscribe from the initial teaser episode, and this has turned into my go-to soccer pod each week. Glad the season is back and happy to call myself a Tad Potter. Thanks, AJ. And his great soccer moment was, AJ says, my soccer moment came during the 2006 World Cup. I'm Italian by heritage. See, we got that in common. Of course we don't hate each other, AJ. I'm a dual citizen. And support the Azzurri. By default, but before 2006, I was only a casual soccer fan. Then Andrea Pirlo happened. I remember watching his goal against Ghana in the group stage and thinking, that just isn't fair. Yes, he's far past his prime now and many years removed from that goal, which is still on YouTube if you want to catch it. But he's a man who really did make this game look entirely too easy. And from that moment, I was hooked. So how old was I? I was like 21, 22. Was in Italy. We played against Italy, and I got a chance to play against Pirlo, and the guy was sick. I mean, this was before he was sort of a big name. He and Cassano were like the up-and-coming Italian players, and they were sort of the stars of the team. And I just remember thinking in the game, this guy has so many different types of passes. I mean, that was one of the things I took. I mean, he was super composed. He was nasty on the ball. He didn't get flustered the whole game. But he had like a golf bag of like different loft in his foot. I mean, he could loft one high that you can get under. He could hit that sort of driven ball. He could put different spin on it. He had a different shape for every pass. And I just thought to myself, okay, I need to work on my game a little bit. And that goal he scored against Ghana shows that he can absolutely crush a ball, too. That was that short corner that got played out to him, and he hammered it in the far post. Yes, he's a bit past his prime, but I still love to watch him play. All right, next one. This is the subject is, you can turn down the volume of the pod, but not the volume of Kyle's hair by Texas Patrick. Really excellent takes with no discernible bias, good format and quality. Fell in love with soccer watching Gareth Bale's hat trick at Inter. Come on, you Spurs. Yeah, that was when he tore my cone apart. Mm-hmm. God. That was kind of the beginning of the end of my cone and the beginning of Gareth Bale being a world superstar. That was insane. All right, last one. This is a great pod by SPWLFC. Best soccer or football, if that's how you prefer it, pod around. I first experienced love for the game when, at age 10, my family went on a trip to London and I saw Fulham-Bolton match at Craven Cottage. Both were in the Premier League, if you can believe it. I do believe it because I loved watching Bolton because of JJ Okocha, of course. And the atmosphere was unreal. However, Steven Gerrard's Liverpool send-off, pregame, not the actual match, was the first time I truly felt emotional for it and realized why it's called The Beautiful Game. Yeah, I mean, what... The Steven Gerrard a lot of people, they haven't really said it yet, but I was on a podcast the other day, a Liverpool podcast, that they do out of Indianapolis, and they asked me one of my sort of favorite Liverpool moments recently, and it was that we go again, Steven Gerrard pump talk right before the tragic Chelsea slip.
That was right after the Manchester City match.
Yeah.
Where everyone thought they were going to win the title after that come from behind win.
Totally. And I thought, kind of like he's saying, you know, it's not necessarily the game itself. It's seeing how much the game means, obviously, to fans, but how much it means to players. And here's Steven Gerrard, who's done so many things in his career, that magical night in Istanbul, and never won a Premier League title, and he sensed that he was close. And I remember, like, the reaction of Raheem Sterling and some of the players when they saw what it meant to Steven Gerrard to be close to that finally. I mean, you could see them, like, getting chills and thinking, this is incredible. So I love when you guys put in the moments that aren't necessarily the moments on the field, because that for me really encapsulates how much this game means to everyone. All right, let's get into these topics. Three topics today, PJ. We got the Manchester clubs. Last season, we were pumped about a Jose Pep battle for a title. It fizzled out and we didn't get it. Are we getting it this season? Number one and number two in the league so far. The next topic, Liverpool struggles. What's going on with Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool? And the first one, Arsenal. So Arsenal went to Stamford Bridge, and typically that means a whooping. You're going to get a whooping. They did not. They did not. And we're going to get into why and kind of look at this Arsenal performance and use it to understand where they are, where they've been, and where they're going. So before the game started, there was a lot of drama, right? So before the game starts, we know Mesut Ozil was injured, so he wasn't available. He wasn't going to be a part of things. Some people sort of knee-jerk snap reaction was, can't believe he's not starting. Well, he was hurt, so that was an easy one. But the person that we couldn't believe wasn't starting is we get the team sheets, we get them an hour before, they print them out, they pass them to us, and you take a look. And we had even heard before that, because of our little birdies that fly around, that there was a chance Alexis wasn't starting. We thought, no chance. I mean, he's got to play him in this game. Alexis on the bench. Mm-hmm. So we immediately, before Arsene Wenger sound comes in, we sit there and we think, okay, but you know, what's the logic behind this? Why would you sit Alexis for a game this big? We go through all of our different thoughts and whatnot, and finally we get a little clue from Arsene Wenger. The sound comes in, he does his pre-match interview, and Arsene Wenger says this.
Because he's injured, and Sanchez is close to his best. He played midweek, and overall, I think he's very close now to start again.
So Arsene Wenger says, you heard him, he's not ready to start. He's close to being ready to start. Well, hold on a second. He started the midweek game. He started in the Europa League. He started against Cologne and played 90 minutes and scored a fantastic goal. He played in World Cup qualifiers with Chile. How on earth is he not ready to start? He's ready to start midweek, but he's not ready to start in the Premier League? I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. And here's the thing is, if it's that he's not ready to start again so quickly, don't play him in the Europa League. Why on earth would you play him in that game against Cologne, knowing you're playing Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, a game you typically lose where you need all your stars? And by the way, Alexis is star number one on that team. Why would you play him midweek? So it doesn't make any sense. And does Arsene Wenger think that we actually believe that? So he doesn't start Alexis, says he's not ready. And you think to yourself, okay, well, why did you start at midweek? And then you say, okay, well, maybe you started at midweek because you're prioritizing, as Manchester United did last year, the Europa League as your way back into the Champions League. But no, because Arsene's told us he isn't. He's gone on record and said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not prioritizing Europa League. We want to get to Champions League through a top four finish in the Premier League. If you want to do that, Arsene Wenger, you have to start Alexis at Stamford Bridge. So what it tells me is that there's still something going on behind the scenes there. Whether it's Alexis is pouting and you know, not being a team player and you know, just kicking up a fuss and not showing the right attitude, yeah, okay, maybe. But I don't know if I buy that one. What it tells me is that they still consider selling him an option, because you feature your star players in your big games if you want to keep them. Now, we all know Alexis Sanchez is in the last year of his contract. It's going to run out at the end of the season. He can leave for free. So that's on the horizon. In January, he can do a pre-contract with a club outside of England. So are they willing to sell him in January? And that's kind of what this is, because they were willing to sell him in the summer. They agreed a fee with Manchester City for him. I mean, that was close to happening. The only reason it didn't is they couldn't get Lamar over the line and get a replacement, if you believe reports. And it didn't really seem like Arsene was denying that, or Ivan Gazidis was denying that. That seemed pretty straightforward. So they were willing to sell Alexis in the summer. They keep him. They're willing to lose him for nothing, I guess, next summer, Arsene Wenger has said. But not starting him in this game tells me maybe they're still thinking about selling him in January and trying to make some coin off of him. Because what other explanation is there for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to get into this a little bit deeper, but his argument will be that it's sort of a tactical reason for doing it. So I guess, would you prefer he would have said that in the pre-match interview, or do you think he would have been putting himself in a dangerous position there? Because then all of a sudden, if they get pumped by Chelsea and he says he left Alexis out for a tactical reason, people are going to be like, what are you thinking? They're going to start to question him again.
Yeah.
But that would have been the more honest answer, based on how things played out, maybe.
Tell the truth.
But does he put himself in a vulnerable spot then? That's maybe why he didn't do that.
I think he puts himself in more of a vulnerable spot by not telling the truth. Because here's the thing. Is if Alexis knows that he's ready to start and he says that, Alexis is going to say, well, this isn't a tactical reason. Now you're not owning up to, you just decided not to use me. So if he said it was a tactical decision, then Alexis would have been like, okay, well, at least you owned up to that. At least you said, this isn't because Alexis isn't ready. This isn't because I can't go out there and start and perform. This is because you've decided not to use me today. And if it doesn't work, it's on you. The good thing is that it didn't hurt them, and they end up getting a good result and have a good performance. But if they didn't, then like the decision to sit him on the bench last season at Anfield against Liverpool, when Alexis comes in second half and makes them a much better team, and you think to yourself, well, what could have happened if he was there from the start? I mean, you could do that for this game at Stamford Bridge. You could say they were dominating in stretches in the first half. I mean, Arsenal looked great. I mean, it was one of the best performances we've seen in the Premier League era at Stamford Bridge. I mean, definitely recently, where they were handling the first wave that Chelsea put at them, dealing with Chelsea kind of dominating on the ball and Arsenal sitting back. The only real time that was a major threat was when Pedro found his way through, but it was a good recovery run from Koscielny. They were able to handle that chance and then kind of took over the game. So if Alexis was out there in that first half, maybe that was your moment to capitalize. So it just doesn't make any sense to me, and I think that continues to be an issue that we're going to have to watch closely. Because Arsene Wenger keeps saying these things where people are smart enough to see that that's not the case. Now, the other thing in the game that was interesting, because it ended up being a moot point based on the performance, I think, is Alexis wasn't out there for the first half. Ozil wasn't out there at all. Mesut Ozil injured meant he didn't have to make a tough decision on whether to put him in this game or not. There are Arsenal fans out there that saw him not available and were happy. I mean, there are Arsenal fans that don't like this guy. I tend to defend him because I think he's a world-class player. I think he gets earmarked as being lazy, and he has that sort of languid style. Even though the stats show he covers just as much ground as others, he's not sprinting a lot. He's not really pressurizing in the way that they need him in games like this, like Iwobi did and like Welbeck did. I mean, that was one of the things about this game that worked really well for Arsenal, is that they pressed the ball well. They were energetic. They were organized. They were disciplined. They were competitive. They were all the things they tend not to be in these big games. So was that because Alexis wasn't there? You know, people will ask themselves, is this indicative of who Arsenal need to be against the big clubs? Do they need to sit Mesut Ozil on the bench in these big games? I don't know. I tend to think no, because he is the type of player in a big game that has the quality that can make a game-changing play, that has the quality that when you're under pressure, he can hold the ball and get you out of tough situations where you haven't possessed the ball much. And in transition, he can help you clear the lines. I mean, he is that player that Germany thinks is one of the first names on the team sheet in the big games. I mean, Jurgen Klopp came out recently in defense of Mesut Ozil to say, you know, we think in Germany that we don't have to defend him being one of the best players. I mean, he's always in our team because he is one of our best players for a national team that's one of the best national teams. So if he's good enough for that, a pragmatic, hardworking, yet offensive-minded and more attacking-minded than they've been in the past, Germany, why is it not good enough for Arsenal? But some will say that in the Premier League, the intensity's up, teams are pressing. I mean, if you look at Spurs and Chelsea and how combative and energetic a lot of these sides are, you can't really carry a player. And if you consider Mesut Ozil a luxury, which some people do, it's a luxury you can't afford in bigger games. So I see that side of the argument. I just don't necessarily agree with it yet. And I'm not sure this game proves that.
Well, I was going to say, if he was healthy in this match, do you think he would have started?
Yeah.
And if so, who would you drop then out of the front three of Welbeck? You would draft Welbeck.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Welbeck, Ozil, and Lacazette.
Arsene Wenger loves him. I mean, absolutely loves him. Puts him in every time he's fit and never takes him out either. I mean, he can kind of do no wrong in the eyes of Arsene Wenger. What I want to see and what I'm desperate to see, and Robbie and I were talking about it this weekend, I want to see Lacazette up high, Alexis on the left, Mesut Ozil floating off the right. I want to see those three together. I mean, that's mouthwatering. I mean, that's one of the more irresistible and exciting top three attacking players. I mean, it's up there with the Firmino, Mane, Salah. It's up there with the Gabriel Jesus, you know, Aguero. You know, add what, Sterling to that, or Sané to that, or even Kevin De Bruyne when he gets a little further forward. I mean, it packs punch like that. I mean, it is a top, you know, top marquee sort of trio there. And we've yet to see it. And I just kind of wonder why that is.
Do you think we would see this same result, performance, though, if those three had started up top?
And that's the big question. That's the big question is, will they get the work rate out of those three? Will they get the intensity and the requisite competitiveness out of those guys? We know the quality's there, of course. I mean, I don't think there is a better attacking trio up top with more quality than those three. But that's the big question. And you know, we'll learn when Mesut Ozil comes back from injury whether or not Arsene Wenger saw that and recognized it and goes that way. And, you know, because Iwobi's a drop-off in talent. Welbeck's a drop-off in talent, but a upgrade in physicality. And with Welbeck, an upgrade in having another sort of striker presence when whether it be Lacazette or Alexis float out of that striker position. You know, it's good that he has options up there, but I just think if they want to win a title, it doesn't have to be with Mesut Ozil out there. I just can't imagine setting up an Arsenal team that you expect to be your best team and not having Mesut Ozil out there. That being said, there might just be games that you can't afford to carry Mesut Ozil in. So Let me just finish with this, because that ended up being sort of critical, when really the point is that was a great performance. That was a great performance from Arsenal. It was, I guess, just disciplined in a way that you don't see them in big games. One of the reasons that they're one of the worst teams on a sort of, if you only had a top six table, they're bottom from last season, is because Arsene Wenger can't help himself. He wants them to dominate and get on the ball and fly forward. And there's just times where that's not the right move. And at Stamford Bridge is exactly the time not to do that. So I was really impressed with when they started to dominate in the first half. I thought to myself, well, here they go. What's going to happen is they're going to feel really good. They're going to get intoxicated with how they're growing into the game. Ramsey's going to continue to fly forward, and then they're going to get caught. And what they did is in the second half, they toned it down a bit and had a very organized, wonderful, competitive, and it just seemed like there was a game plan. And that's the big thing. We never really can find a game plan from Arsenal in these big games where they end up getting thrashed. It looked like that at Stamford Bridge. What I want to see now, kind of like a few seasons ago when they did it at the Etihad against Manchester City, I want to see them stick with that in these big games. I want to see, you know, There are definitely occasions like the FA Cup final when you can dominate in a big game, as they did against Chelsea that day. but they just have to know when the day isn't theirs. There's a different way to go get points, and they proved that at Stamford Bridge, and I thought that was really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to just say that this is what we always criticize Wenger when he doesn't do this sort of thing, and he did it. And
yeah,
he made the controversial choices, but in the end, this is what all the critics are calling for. And like you brought up that Man City game, this is the same thing. Everybody was so impressed. I remember he brought Coquelin into midfield with Cazorla, and that's where that game that changed that whole game. And it's a similar thing here, where he makes another sort of controversial lineup decision, but you get the result. You want going to Stamford Bridge if you're an Arsenal fan. I mean, obviously you'd take the 3 points if you can get it, but I think most Arsenal fans would be happy with a nil
draw.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, they have to leave there feeling good about that performance for sure and being able to grow on it. And we'll see if they can. But Arsene Wenger gets a lot of criticism. We criticize him, as you said. So on the day, he deserves credit. There are issues that are still there. The Alexis thing is still strange. But in isolation, on that day, Arsene Wenger got out of his team what he needed to in a very difficult game, so he deserves credit. All right, let's move on to a manager not really getting everything he needs to out of his team, Jurgen Klopp. Okay, I started the season very high on Jurgen Klopp, very high on Liverpool. I remain high on them, although it's becoming harder and harder to defend my top four prediction for them, simply because I felt very good about myself after they... they hammered Arsenal, right? I mean, they win that game. They look incredible. I'm feeling like, you know what? I called this one, all right? And I'm sure if I listen back to the pod, and if you haven't, go back and listen to that Tad Pod and tweet me and make fun of me. But I'm sure I gloated a little bit and said, here we go. This is Liverpool. Now, what's happened since then? A transfer window where they failed to bring in any of their targets, really. I mean, to bring in any of the required targets that were going to make them title contenders in my mind. They kept Coutinho, which makes that, I would say, a good transfer window because that was difficult to turn down Barcelona, especially with the money they were throwing. They got Naby Keita, who's coming next season. That's good. So not a disastrous transfer window, but you needed a center back. You needed Virgil van Dijk. But if you couldn't get him, don't put all your eggs in that basket. And it seems like that's what they've done, is they put all their eggs in the Virgil van Dijk basket. They didn't go and find an option B. They didn't go to find a backup plan. And now they're left with a center back trio, whether it be on the day a pair of Klavan and Lovren or Matip, any permutation, is just not good enough for how they play. If they were a more sit-back kind of counter team, they probably could get away with not having the talent at center back that they lack. But the fact that they're a pressing team, the fact that they come out of this medium block and want to gain ground up the field, that they want to play a high back line, that they want to win the ball far up the field, that they want to attack with numbers, that they want to be energetic and heavy metal football, as Jurgen Klopp calls it, what that creates is a risk. It was there at Borussia Dortmund, but he had the requisite center backs to handle it. And it's here at Liverpool. What it creates is you don't face a lot of shots, and Liverpool on the list of shots faced is only bettered by Manchester City. But what happens is the shots you face are very clear-cut goal-scoring chance, high-percentage shot chances, right? And comparing them to Manchester City have faced just a few less shots this season than Liverpool have. But Liverpool have faced three times the amount of clear-cut goal-scoring chances. So there are two problems. One is center backs aren't reading danger. They're not sniffing out in transition where the trouble is. And in this last game, they decided to rest Henderson. Obviously struggles with plantar fasciitis. He has foot injuries. He struggled with it in the past. It's going to be difficult for him to play midweek and the weekend. So used Emre Can there, a position he hasn't played a ton for the team. Jorginho Wijnaldum was rested as well. So now you have even more pressure on that back line because you're missing some of the usual players. And what happens is when you play the pressing style as Manchester City does, as Spurs do, you need either a remarkable center midfielder who smells that danger, who's your first insurance policy that cuts things out and sort of cordons off the midfield line to trap the ball forward and keep that attack going and sort of, recycle that attack and keep feeding those guys and not letting the team transition. Or you need great center backs that do that, or you need a great goalkeeper. And they don't have any of those things. So Manchester United, for instance. Manchester United is a team that doesn't face a lot of shots, but they face a lot of high clear-cut goal-scoring opportunity shots, right? So that tells me they've got some center back issues, which they do, but they've got a remarkable goalkeeper. And look at the game against Everton. He comes up with two huge saves. In the moments where Everton were dominating that game, Manchester United, I mean, that wasn't a 4-0 game. It ended up there, obviously, but Manchester United were struggling during a stretch, and Everton were cutting through and getting the best of that back line. So Liverpool, it's just baffling that they haven't addressed this issue. And they don't need a change of style. This is what worked at Borussia Dortmund. This is what makes Liverpool so fun to watch. It's what makes them irresistible, especially in big games when teams open up and try to build out of the back and Liverpool just tear them apart. I mean, that's why they were the best team of the top six last year, because that style works so well in those scenarios. But here's a game against Burnley that they absolutely dominated. They were excellent. I mean, the ball movement, Coutinho was back. He played the midfield three. He looks short on full match fitness, but he was outstanding. You know, he's picking the team apart, great opportunities, combining with Firmino. Sturridge looked bright in that game. Solanke came on and looked good. Trent Alexander-Arnold had an excellent game. I mean, all throughout the team, it was an excellent performance, except for one long ball. Trent Alexander-Arnold doesn't win it. Matip and Klavan fall asleep for a second. Neither of them challenge the ball. You know what I call it? It's that bystander phenomenon. You know, it's like someone else will handle this, so I'm not going to handle it. That's kind of how that Liverpool back line defends at times, where there just isn't that aggression and that intuition to see where you're vulnerable while you're in possession.
We often talk about partnerships and, you know, center back, maybe in midfield. You know, you brought up the lineup changes. How important is that, not only just at center back defensively, but across the pitch? So, for example, you already brought up Matip, Lovren, and Klavan all kind of switching. So there's not a consistent center back pairing that's being formed there. In midfield, it was Milner and Coutinho who came in. Chan stayed in, but like you said, Wijnaldum and Henderson had been there with Chan normally. That trio seemed like they were beginning to form a pretty good relationship.
Yeah.
And then you bring in, obviously, Mane suspended, so you either bring Coutinho up top to replace him, but he put him in midfield, so you bring Sturridge in. So now you have, you've got Salah, Sturridge in the middle, which is normally where Firmino plays, and Firmino on the left. So he's going to have to rotate, obviously, with Champions League and all these competitions.
Yeah.
But you just see, when you compare to the Champions League squad, there's a lot of changes to make from one game to the next. So could a lot of the issues result, you know, could that be the result of some of these issues that he's
lack of continuity?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So look at the three teams that have won the title. Well, it's two teams, but the three last titles, right? Chelsea, Leicester, and then Chelsea. Those teams pick themselves every single week. You knew exactly who was going to play.
Yeah, Leicester was
they almost never changed.
Week.
I mean, it was the best because our graphic department basically could just use last week's team every single time. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. When you want to be a team that in Leicester's case, was a counterattacking team, but a true traditional counterattacking team, you need to understand the tendencies of each other. I mean, you really have to work at that. And then when you want to be the type of team that Liverpool want to be, right, if you want to be a team that's going to be risky and you're going to fly forward and you're going to try to press the ball, try to win it further up the field, you need to know that you're going to be breached. It's going to happen. All the best pressing teams in the world eventually get breached. I mean, look at Spurs. How do Spurs handle it? Well, one, whether it's Dier or Wanyama, those guys are so good at being disciplined and understanding where they need to position themselves to make them less vulnerable to the counterattack. The next thing is Alderweireld and Vertonghen. I mean, those guys have played probably more games together than any other defensive duo I can think of because of playing for club and country. So they played together for obviously for Belgium, for Ajax, and now for Spurs. So there's that sort of preternatural understanding, that symbiosis where you know what to expect. You know your guy's tells before he goes there. You know where his weaknesses are, so you make sure you cover that. So, yeah, that's absolutely important. The other thing that Spurs have is an excellent goalkeeper that's quick off his line. So, you know, some of the goals recently, you can't blame on Mignolet. You can't blame on Karius, who we've seen a little bit. But you know, that's my Manchester United comparison, is that when they do get breached and they get through, you need a guy that can bail you out. And too often, Liverpool goalkeepers aren't bailing them out. Too often, the center backs are being beaten too easily. And too often, there isn't the same pair or trio in the middle ahead of that back line. So, you know, Jurgen Klopp is kind of getting away with the fact that there aren't a lot of expectations on this team. So the fact that a lot of people didn't put them in the top four is the reason that people aren't screaming for his job right now. Now, I know Liverpool fans are getting upset and some people are starting to talk about that, but he's not nearly under the criticism he should be under if he was a true title contender. So, I mean, the transfer window wasn't great. You lose 5-0 to Manchester City. Obviously, there's a red card in that, but they're 1-0 at that point, and they completely capitulate. They draw 2-2 with Sevilla, a game that they were dominating, and it was another defensive error by Lovren. And then you draw 1-1 with Burnley. So the pressure at some point has to come on to Jurgen Klopp, where you say, listen, there's been progress, and I've seen progress, and I think it continues to tick better. But it just seems like a major error to not have bought the caliber sort of last-line defender that could mitigate a lot of the risk that they take and let them win 1-0 against Burnley at home. They should have won that game 1-0. No questions asked. There's no way they should have conceded a long, predictable long ball into the box that three defenders had a chance to make a play on, and no one does, and Arfield buries it.
Just real quickly with Klopp. So you're saying the main reason he's not getting any criticism is because the expectations aren't that high for Liverpool.
If he was at Manchester City right now, if he was at Manchester United, or, I mean, Chelsea, Manchester City, Manchester United, if he's one of these clubs that's expected to be in a title race every year, he'd be getting criticized a lot more than he's getting criticized right now.
The reason I just ask is because I wonder with him specifically, especially, you know, the reporters or whatever, he comes up in the pre-match interview, he's very friendly, almost like maybe gives him a hug or whatever, who knows, but he's just such a likable personality that I think some of the journalists that are really close to him might be reluctant to criticize him sometimes. I wonder if that's part of the issue sometimes too with him and Liverpool, and we kind of give him a pass.
You know, a perfect example of that was Claudio Ranieri. Not only what he did, but who he is. He's an amazing guy. He's so lovable. So people didn't want to criticize him when it was clear things were going wrong under his watch and he was culpable. Not entirely responsible, but definitely culpable. You didn't see anyone giving him a hard time through that stretch. And there was like a candlelight vigil when he lost his job. So Klopp kind of is the same thing because you love him so much. You know, Arsene Wenger kind of has fallen in that category over the years because he's so respectful to the journalists. He's so likable and affable. I mean, Klopp definitely gets the benefit of the doubt for that. But I think he gets the benefit of the doubt because they're just not, again, the expectations aren't as high on Liverpool, obviously because they've never won a Premier League title, but because they haven't spent as much as other teams. They don't, on paper, have the sort of depth that other teams have. People don't put them in their top four. I mean, I was one of the only pundits out there that put them in the top four. So I think he gets the benefit of people not realizing they are good enough and they should be doing better. So I'm going to be critical because they're in the top four. They should be better than this right now, and I think they are better than this. Now, the good thing is Lallana, he's about a month away, so he comes back, he helps things. Mane, two more games?
Actually, yeah, because they've got the League Cup, which he'll get one there.
And so Mane, weekend. So Mane's back, and
so he should be done after
Henderson,
weekend,
obviously, Wijnaldum come back into the team. So you know, it's early in the season, but they're better than what they're showing right now. All right. On to two teams that are very difficult to criticize right now because they're 1-2 in the league. And the two most dominant teams so far, just tearing teams apart. There's magic in Manchester right now. And I'm just, as a soccer fan, so glad to see it. Because last year when the news came out, you know, obviously the news came out that Pep Guardiola was coming to the Premier League halfway through the season before that. But the news that Jose Mourinho was going to be in Manchester as well came out in the summer, and everyone lost their minds. I was so excited to see a Pep-Jose battle for the title. I mean, these guys going at it as they did in Spain. It was as good as you could write it. I mean, a script writer's dream. I mean, that is a Hollywood script of these two rivals, two of the most successful managers in the game, in the same city, at two historic clubs, two successful clubs, Manchester City in the modern era, Manchester United, obviously historically and not as recently. That was going to be it. And last year was a dud. I mean, we were all left very disappointed. First at Manchester United falling away, and then eventually Manchester City falling away as well. This season, it looks like it's here. It looks like this is a battle that will play out throughout the season. The only thing that separates them right now is alphabetical yep. order. And we were sitting there in the studio saying, wait, hold on a second. You're looking down there like, all right, goals conceded. Like, they're identical right now. Mm-hmm. So I guess what we should do is what differentiates them so far. I think that Manchester City look a little bit further along than Manchester United do. You know, neither have had a lot of tests so far. You know, Manchester City have had more tests than Manchester United have had. Manchester United's biggest test has this season come in the last game against Everton, and they, you know, didn't look convincing through a lot of it. You know, there were stretches there where the game kind of could have gone either way, and you know, I give credit to Everton. They came with a good game plan. It was executed well. I thought Wayne Rooney was really good on the day. You know, they concede early with a wonder goal from Antonio Valencia, and then they claw the game back and look to be the better team through most of the first half. But that's what you have to be careful with a Jose Mourinho team is kind of don't be confused with them sitting back and not dominating possession and not being the aggressors. Don't confuse that with things not going to plan. I mean, that kind of is the plan. Mm-hmm. And Robbie Musto, I think, put it really well after the game where he said, that's kind of just a typical, traditional Jose Mourinho game right there, where you get on top early, you're the aggressor, you get comfortable, and then you sit back and just let the other team kind of fall into that false sense of security that having the ball a lot gives you, and then you just punish them. And I think the big difference between this season and last season with Manchester United is when that game plan is used, when they try to execute it, they have the quality in the final third for it to work. I mean, they are much more ruthless in counterattack in the final third than they were last season or the season before or since Sir Alex Ferguson left. So Lukaku continues to score goals. Rashford continues to look a threat. Martial continues to look dangerous off the bench. Mkhitaryan continues to look amazing. And the Mkhitaryan thing is really interesting because, you know, Jose Mourinho, if you look at some players, like some stars that Jose Mourinho has gotten rid of in the past, Kevin De Bruyne, right? Jose Mourinho, no, it's not happening at Chelsea. You're not going to get in here. He leaves, and now he's one of the best players in the Premier League. Pep Guardiola said he's one of the best players he's ever seen. Mo Salah, right? Jose Mourinho gets a look at him. No, nah, I'm not really feeling it. Mo Salah leaves, goes to do well in Roma. Now he comes back, and he's one of the best players in the Premier League so far this season. Mkhitaryan, he stayed. You know, that's what's interesting is, you know, Kevin De Bruyne was the Bundesliga Player of the Year when he got him. That didn't impress Jose Mourinho. He left and then became afterwards Kevin De Bruyne.
He left.
He didn't get him as the Bundesliga Player.
No, exactly. He left, went to Wolfsburg.
But obviously he left and became the Bundesliga Player in that next season. So Mkhitaryan comes and Jose's not feeling it. He wasn't playing a lot last year, and it just seemed like it had the writings of, okay, here's another star that we all see is incredibly talented that Jose Mourinho doesn't like, and he's just going to ship him out. But he stayed. So maybe that has to do with Kevin De Bruyne and Mo Salah just angled to get out. They weren't happy, and they weren't willing to sit and buy their time, and Mkhitaryan was. So maybe it's just Mkhitaryan showed a lot of maturity and belief in himself that he knew he could break into the team eventually. But I look at it as a good on Mourinho as well.
Well, I was going to bring up also he's got Juan Mata and Romelu Lukaku playing, two players he also sold.
Yeah.
And he's relying on them heavily too. So maybe this is a sign that he is adapting, and he's starting to consider players like that that he used to toss aside and say, you know what, these guys can be useful for me, and I'm going to play them.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. I was just thinking that, you know, part of me worries that Jose still has that nerve in him where he can snap and he can lose it, and we haven't seen rainy days yet for him. The only one we've seen is Stoke, and he had that awkward interview afterwards where he told the reporter it was a bad question. So let's wait to see when a rainy day comes if he does kind of relapse and fall into that antagonistic, paranoid Jose Mourinho. But so far, there's so many examples of them being good and him having what he needs, the ingredients to have a Jose Mourinho type title winning team. It's always in his second season that he does it. So he has to know enough about his group now. He has acquired the pieces he needs. So the stage is set. But I do still think there's some defensive issues. The center back pairings, he kind of adjusts them a little bit. He's gone with Jones and Smalling a lot. It does feel like that's still a concern, and that's still an issue.
Even at fullback, he played two. I mean, again, Valencia has been one of their most consistent players the last couple of seasons playing at fullback, but he's still a winger, and he played Ashley Young at left back.
Yeah.
So he's playing two guys that are normally wingers, and he trusts them more than traditional fullback. So that's sort of, I think that's going to be
another issue as well. Paul Pogba, they're obviously not as good without him. I mean, that's an easy statement. I think everyone anticipated that, so that's no big groundbreaking analysis right there. But they're much better when Paul Pogba's out there. So him being out for maybe a month could hurt them a little bit. Let's move it on to Manchester City and kind of talk about why I think they're a little bit ahead of Manchester United. A lot of the what do we got here? This is hot off the press. This is hot off the press. PJ just handed me this. It says it's the best minutes per goal ratio in the Premier League history. Gabriel Jesus, 88.82. Sergio Aguero, 108.44. So, I mean, these guys, best minutes per goal ratio in Premier League history, are at the beginning of the season as irresistible as a Premier League pair has ever been. So we'll see if that continues. But what it says is that, and we're going to power through the whistle on this one because we're obviously talking about two different clubs. But what it says is the final third is as good as it's ever been at Manchester City. I mean, it's remarkable the talent they have, the attacking talent that they have. And they had it last year. They had a lot of attacking talent last year. But if you ask Pep Guardiola what bothered him from last season for Manchester City, he'll tell you it was the attacking side of things. He's not going to say, you know, how bad we were in the back. He's not going to say his goalkeeper. He's not going to say the lack of fullbacks. He's not going to say Vincent Kompany being hurt all the time. He's going to say that they were profligate in front of goal, that they wasted chances. And he did. He did all the time. Every time someone wanted to bait him into an answer to admit that he's playing the wrong goalkeeper, he's playing the wrong defensive unit, or he shouldn't be playing John Stones, or whatever it is, he would never fall into that trap. He would always just say, well, if we finish our chances, that wouldn't be an issue. And he's right to a certain extent. They created a ton of chances they should have finished last year. I mean, they were not good enough in the final third. His Barcelona team, his Bayern Munich team were clinical. And so far, Manchester City this season is absolutely clinical. And Sergio Aguero obviously can play as lone strikers. I mean, typically, Pep Guardiola doesn't like strike partnerships. I mean, he likes attacking players near each other. He likes false nines. He likes a striker. He likes wingers. He likes inverted wingers. He doesn't like strike partnerships. We've seen that a little bit this year, them played as a strike partnership. But what we're going to see is them given a free role in sort of a 4-3-3 where Gabriel Jesus more than likely will be off the left, and they'll be allowed to float around. And when they do that, I mean, Kevin De Bruyne and David Silva doing the defensive side of things as well when they play with only one holder in Fernandinho. I mean, they've reinvented themselves as just complete box-to-box midfielders that don't lose any of the attacking production by being a little bit deeper. And I'm loving it. And what makes them further along than Manchester United for me goes to what you were saying. Is Manchester United, the center backs and fullbacks are an issue. The back line is not as strong as the record shows, and no team has really tested them enough to prove that. David De Gea has been their best player over the last five seasons, and so far he's kind of up there with Lukaku and Pogba this year. But Manchester City spent huge money on Kyle Walker, Danilo, and Mendy, and all of them are performing. All of them offer the attacking threat that they didn't get out of their old fullbacks, but more importantly, all of them offer the athleticism and nous to help when they turn the ball over, to help recover in dangerous situations. And what that's turned them into is, and this was the big piece missing, together with the attacking side of things, this was the bigger piece missing last season for Manchester City. If you compare it to Barcelona and other teams that Pep have had, they didn't press well. They didn't win the ball back that well. Go watch the last game. They scored half of those goals winning the ball further up the field. I mean, that is who – it's the six-second rule is basically what Pep Guardiola calls it. You need to, when you lose the ball, win it back within 6 seconds. And so what Barcelona did to teams so well is they got so many players forward. They got on top of you. They got you off balance. They got you on your heels. They got you in your defensive third. And once you win the ball
– we're going to power through.
We're powering through. Once you win the ball – I mean, you have like vertigo. You're looking at four or five players sprinting at you. You're jelly legged, and you struggle to find anyone to help get you out of pressure. So what you end up doing is you either try to keep the ball on the ground, and it gets caught out, and you turn it over, or you just lump it, and then they're back down your throat. And Manchester City is doing that to teams this year. So. There's nothing separating Manchester City and Manchester United on points. There's nothing separating them on wins. There's only something separating them on alphabetical order. That's the only reason Manchester City sit top of the table right now. But I just feel that in terms of the overall project, both of them have made a lot of progress, and Manchester City seems to be further down the line and closer to what a Pep Guardiola team looks like than Manchester United seem close to what a Jose Mourinho team looks like.
I want to bring up two quick points. You talked about the pressing and those specific signings, and I think the key thing about them, not just in their quality, is their age. Benjamin Mendy's only 23, Danilo's 26, Kyle Walker 27. They replace essentially Sanya, Clichy, Kolarov, all in their 30s. So I think that age difference is huge if you want to have a pressing game like that.
Totally.
Because they can, that when you're younger, you can obviously run a lot longer and press like that. And also John Stones is only 23 years old, so you have a back line of guys that are all in their mid to early 20s.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary to think about.
It's like they bought the defenders they sold, they bought those defenders' kids.
Yeah, exactly.
but here's one other subtle nuance of a Pep Guardiola team that's showing up in this current side in his Manchester City group. There's always like a little thing that Jose finds, that Pep Guardiola finds that's a tweak. It's like he has an epiphany of, okay, this is what we need to do. You know, it was sort of how he used Messi with Barcelona, mm-hmm. and redefined his position.
A false nine.
Yeah, it was how he played fullback centrally, how he used Philipp Lahm and Alaba with Bayern Munich. And now with Manchester City, watch how he uses John Stones. Recently, John Stones has been leaving the back line to make up the numbers in the midfield. So Pep is always looking for how to create overloads and how to dominate certain areas of the field so that the ball can be delivered to attacking players with space facing forward. He's doing that recently with John Stones. So keep an eye when they play in a back four, which they've been doing a lot recently. John Stones will leave the back four to make up numbers in the midfield to pick it up. And Fernandinho will be aware of that. Sometimes he'll drop back to help out and protect
that. We saw that a lot, I think, this past Saturday.
Yeah.
We saw Fernandinho.
So it's obvious they've worked on it. It's obvious. And it's funny because I remember the first season, Robbie Musto and I were having a debate, and I was saying, I'm surprised with John Stones struggling a little bit in the back line. They haven't tried him in the midfield. Mm-hmm. You know, like Mascherano being used as a center back or Busquets being used as a center back and sort of interchanging and using players in those different roles. I was surprised he didn't use John Stones, at least just as a trial, at least just to test it, in a defensive midfield position, especially when they were light there and needing to go back to Yaya Toure after that whole mess with his agent and Sulik just insulting Pep Guardiola left and right. So I think that's how he's accomplishing that, is he loves John Stones. He does. He loves the project, but recognizes that it's still a project. So sometimes he brings him out of the team. Sometimes he plays a back three. But you know, he definitely – that's the little subtle change I've seen that's going to be that sort of marquee Pep Guardiola, you know, twist his mustache, mad scientist thing that he tends to develop from – Pep Confidential, if you haven't read that book, is a great one. He tends to develop in a part of his house that's his office, that's sort of his underground lair that he locks himself in and watches tape after tape after tape. And when he makes this epiphany, as he did with Alaba and Lahm and how to use them for Bayern Munich, he tends to call in his kids to show them and say, look at what daddy figured out.
Nerd.
So any way you slice it, there's not a whole lot separating the Manchester clubs. It's great to think that Manchester United could be back to being a title contender. It's premature for me, but you know, some performances definitely support that. I think one thing's for sure, they are going to be better than they were last season. We'll see if they can sustain it. We'll see if Jose finds that back line that he really trusts and he really feels good about. And then it would just be amazing if we get down the stretch and both of these clubs are battling for a title. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I hope for. And then in a Tad Pod, you know, 10 years from now, one of the reviews, someone's going to say, you know, the time I fell in love with the game was watching in 2017-18 Manchester clubs battling for the title. We look forward to that moment. But that was a fun Tad Pod, guys. Any back injury suggestions at Kyle Martino? Help me out. I'm struggling here. I tried to stay chipper. I tried to stay positive during the pod, but I'm going to go home and ice my back. You guys enjoy your week. Enjoy the weekend. We'll see you for some big ones again this weekend. Then we'll see you for another Tad Pod next week. So thanks for listening. And as always, guys, stay on your feet.